Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 1 of Andy Zaltzman's Summer of Sports, the Guardian's new everything apart from football sports podcast with me, Andy Zaltzman, the alleged comedian, also no times capped international cricketer, currently ranked in the top 3 billion in the ATP Men's Tennis World Rankings, and proud owner of a 25-metre swimming badge. They don't just throw them around these days. Over the next 12 weeks, I and my guests will be exclusively covering literally every single sporting event in the known universe, if not more, apart from football. No football. This is not an anti-football show. I like football. Like other sports, it's better than, for example, reality and news. But enough people talk about it already, and this show is dedicated to other stuff, especially sport. Only sport. It's a sports show. Anyway, what's a summer of sports? We have coming up for you, ranging from Rio 2016 to everything else. And later in this show, we ask, is the lack of genuine overtaking manoeuvres in Formula One helping to improve road safety amongst ordinary drivers?
Well, I'll take my lead in life from celebrities, as is my patriotic duty as a citizen of the 21st century. So when driving, I now opt for a strategic fuel and tyre preservation-based approach to family car journeys, rather than one based on high-risk overtaking manoeuvres.
In our new You Be The Umpire quiz, we ask, is this out or not out? And we will be looking at how badminton as a sport has changed since the sport outlawed the use of live shuttlecocks.
Well, of course, we tried using shuttle hens for a bit, but they just flew off, whereas the more aggressive shuttlecocks would stay and try to fight so you could have a proper game with them. I know they'd been rallied and smashed to the point of extinction, but still, it changed our sport forever. Thank you, Brussels.
But first, time to meet our guests for this week's show. Firstly, from the Guardian's sports writing pages, it's Emma John, author of the recently published Following On, a memoir of teenage obsession and terrible cricket. A book about growing up following the England cricket team in the 1990s when, if memory serves, we did not win 100% of our matches.
We didn't win 50% of our matches.
We won 50% of some of the matches that we then went on to lose.
That's correct.
Yeah, there were straws to cling to. welcome, Emma. And also comedian, sports connoisseur and full-time Andy Murray enthusiast. It's Mark Steele.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
This is just... I'd happily just do these podcasts all day long through the night and everything.
Yeah.
This is
well. That's because sport is a refuge from everything, isn't it?
Well, no. I think other things are. Sport is the reality, really.
Right.
I didn't realise how bad I was until I was coming back from a show one night, and someone was driving me. This bloke was sort of stopping at my place, and we got in at about 3, having got back from somewhere like Darlington, and we got in, and I put the telly on, which I always do in those situations, and he thought it was odd because I went, "Oh, table tennis," and he thought that was odd. Oh, the Australian Open was on, I think, later in the week. Then he came down at about sort of six in the morning, and he'd got a stick, and he come through the door. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "It's you." I said, "Of course it's me." He said, I thought there was a burglar." In my own house, because I was watching Murray in the Australian Open and sort of going, and he thought it was this sort of really burglar, but the sort of burglar who shouts things like, "Get it over the net!" not first-rate burglary, is it?
Where else to begin this new series of Summer of Sports podcasts but curling? The notoriously ice-based winter sport that has been rocked to it, literally rocked to its rocky foundations at the recent sweeping summit in Ottawa. Mark, perhaps you could fill us in on some of the details from it. I mean, it's probably the biggest story in world sport for at least 1,000 years.
It is, and in a way, because the same is that you get the people who don't like sport or don't, I go, "Oh, it's pointless, it's just, you know, 22 men running about or whatever, you know," and they don't realize that it is just a little symbol of life in general. Now here, curling, which I'm sure most people are familiar with what goes on, they might not be aware of the reasons for it, but a stone is launched and then people pursue it, the rest of the team pursue it with these brooms that that sort of affects the ice and therefore speeds up or slows down the stone and so on. And then it has to go roughly where you're trying to get the stone in a sort of little, this funny little game. But a new sort of broom has been invented where the broom head has these different sort of prickles on it. And it can affect the ice in such a way that the stone can now be turned left or right much more sharply, almost like a sort of, almost as if it's remote controlled. And the effect on this, it means that you can take the stone either 6 foot further or 4 foot less than with the old broom heads. And they've had to have a special conference in Ottawa. What do we do? The new technology, is it? I mean, it's the same as you get in, well, with cricket, with the bats. Oh, is it the same? The tennis rackets, golf clubs. Oh, now they, you know, if they got a golf club that could knock a ball 500 yards, then someone who was hopeless at golf could be getting on the green in one, couldn't they? So, yeah, and the same with life, you know, artists, you know, or musicians. Oh, that's not music now that you just have to go ping, ping, ping and you can make a symphony. That's not like proper music like Mozart. This is it's a philosophical
that
question
really
of our
true.
Age.
Yes. I think that's really true. I think sport is always at the forefront of how do we feel about embracing technology and how do we feel about modern life progressing? Because I think sport is inherently conservative. You can see that from the way that, you know, football reacted to video, use of video ref. Yeah. Sport is inherently, we don't want anything to change because this is the way that we believe the world should be. It should be governed by these particular rules.
Yes.
And it's constantly coming up against these
things. That being said, I don't think any of us expected curling brooms to be at the very forefront of the technological revolution, but here we are.
Well, can I just explain to you about the curling brooms and the curling broom technology, because I actually have some personal experience of this.
Right.
Because I don't know if you two might have had this same experience. Have you both played against a Great Britain curling team?
Not often. Not knowingly.
Sorry. I did spend a day curling. You can go to Tunbridge Wells, right? It's the only curling rink in England is in Tunbridge Wells. It's a bloke who converted his farm. So sort of, you know, more conservative farmers, if things aren't quite going well, the EU subsidy isn't going the way it expected, they'll go, oh, we'll turn it into bed and breakfast, maybe have some pick around strawberries, something like that. This bloke, he's gone, I'll turn the farm into a curling rink. And so I had a day, my wife got it for me birthday, and it was, she knows.
Who
me,
says
so,
romance is dead?
Yeah. Oh, it was brilliant. It's brilliant.
And actually harder than you think, isn't it, Mark?
It's right hard,
because
yeah.
I think that's it. People watch it on the screen, and it looks really easy. It looks like you're sliding this thing along the ground. Mm. You know, you're not even throwing something through the air, so you don't even have that to contend with. You just push it. It all looks so staid and gentle. And actually, it's an incredibly physical game, and the broom technology comes into this. When you watch the sweepers going down the ice sheet, that they look like they're kind of sweeping away, and we imagine our granny out with a, you know, with a sweep. Actually,
well,
you
Lynn
are having
Smith,
to
bless her, used to call it housework on ice, didn't
yeah you? Well, actually, you're having to press down, you're having to push down so hard with that broom in order to get the friction on the ice, which
hence
is what creates the heat.
They had to test 50 different brushes at the sweeping summit 2016 in Ottawa, because the sport is on a knife edge.
Called it a joystick. You know, they've called these brooms a joystick, so you can guide the stone in a way that wasn't previously possible. I don't know what the answer is.
It's like
I don't
Formula
know which
One,
to take.
Isn't it? It's all going to be done from the pit lane soon, isn't it? It's all going to be remote controlled. Where's the humanity in modern curling? A very depressing way to start this series. Let's move on to
tennis.
Andy Murray managed to do what no other British tennis player has ever done, and that is lose to Novak Djokovic in a French Open final. Now, Mark, I know you're a big tennis fan and an even bigger Andy Murray fan. You've tracked his career from the early days through the triumphs and nearly triumphs, of which he's now had a spectacular number. How does he go about beating Djokovic now?
Again, the philosophy of this is immense, isn't it? What must it be like to be the second best, clearly the second best in the world at something that lots of people like and want to do? Would that make you feel marvellous? You know, you can go, that means he can fly over Tokyo and go, none of you are anywhere near as good as me. Even if Kei Nishikori happens to be there at the time, you're nowhere near as good as me. Anywhere, Mexico, Greenland, wherever he goes in the world, just one Serbian bastard. And so would you think this is, I'm second best, or would you think, there's something about Murray that is just so beautifully anti-celebrity, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what I've liked about him from the very beginning. And I think that's what I used to get incredibly frustrated about, the way that he was portrayed. Mm. It was that classic thing where it was like, he was sort of vilified for just being an ordinary bloke.
Yeah.
And for not wanting to play the game, not wanting to be famous, not wanting to do anything but win.
Basically, I think beating Djokovic now, I would not just put as the most difficult thing in sports, but probably one of the most difficult things in the world. I put it alongside finding a long-term solution to the Middle East crisis and getting through an entire TV debate on Europe without throwing a brick through your television and shouting, I wish humans had never bothered evolving. I put it up in that level of difficulty. Also, it wasn't just the gluten. In 2012, then this was just after that US Open final that he lost to Murray, he bought the entire global supply of the world's most expensive donkey cheese.
How much was that?
And since then, I don't know. But since then, he's been basically unbeatable. So I don't know how.
Injecting donkey cheese? Is that what you're accusing him of? Djokovic is doping with donkey cheese.
I'm sure.
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm sure it's, you know, medically advisable.
Well, he is like...
I don't know. They've got Sharapova. He could be the next one to go.
Donkey cheese.
Imagine if it turned out that he'd been having an illegal quantity of donkey cheese. Then all of his, it'd be like Lance Armstrong.
Yeah.
All of those would be, and Murray would be like, he'd be 8 Grand Slams, wouldn't he? He'd be up there, he'd be almost up with Agassi in that.
Yeah.
He's lost 5, hasn't he, to Djokovic? So he'd have 7 titles.
Do you not think that Murray's going to have his day? Because all this stuff that we're saying about Djokovic was exactly the same thing we used to say about Federer. And Federer and Nadal specifically. When is Nadal going to get his chance? And he
did. You say about Federer whilst sighing slightly at the eternal beauty of his tennis, whereas Djokovic, there's more of a kind of grudging respect to his futuristic functionality.
I don't agree with that. I think he is astonishing. And I think his physique is part of it. He's not power. That he's like a cartoon, isn't he? You see him sort of right over the other, oh, right, well, he can't possibly win this point now. Yeah. The opponent's only just got to get it back. And Djokovic is in the corner, and he's turned inside out, and then he sort of goes doing like a cartoon.
He watched a lot of Inspector Gadget as a child. Djokovic influenced his tennis deeply. As a result, the years of hurt go on. 40 years at the French Open since Sue Barker won her French Open. 50 years since a British player won the French Open without subsequently going on to host Question of Sport. That was Anne Haydon-Jones in 1966. Surely the sporting highlight of that summer. And Hayden Jones winning the French Open, 66. But for the men, 81 years of hurt since Perry won his only French Open title. 79 years since Bunny Austin, last Brit to reach the final before Murray this year. Since then, so many near misses. Graham Stilwell losing in straight sets in the third round in 1971, for example. Andrew Castle not making it out of qualifying for the 1987 tournament. And Anastasia Miskina winning at Roland Garros in 2004, but being, unfortunately, both Russian and a woman. So that's a long time we've been waiting for a British man to win the French Open. I'll tell you the only way to beat him. It's all down to this gluten. There needs to be some kind of... Murray needs to hire a kind of KGB spy to jab him in the leg with an umbrella that injects a bread roll into him, and then get the gluten back in his system.
Or swap the donkey cheese for something else, like sea lion cheese.
Yeah. That's kryptonite. That is tennis kryptonite, sea lion cheese.
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
Now, throughout the Summer of Sports show, we will be giving away weekly a free gift. And this week, part one of our audio Olympic wall chart. Simply fill in the blanks as the Olympics unfolds on your own sound recorder to build up a complete audio record of Rio 2016. And to get you started, athletics.
Event, men's 1500 metres. Gold.
Fill in the winner's name here.
Silver.
Second place name here.
Bronze.
I think you've got the idea by now.
Winning time. World stroke regional stroke national records broken. Failed drugs tests. Definite question marks. And unarguable choke on the big stage.
So fill in the gaps. And by the end of the summer, you'll have something to play to your grandchildren in 60 years' time.
Cricket!
England are currently, as we record, just starting day 2 of the final test against Sri Lanka, 2-0 up in the series at last, vengeance for all the historic wrongs that have been wrought upon the British nation by the mighty Sri Lankan Empire. That's what international sport's all about, basically, isn't it? Emma, now you have written your book about the difficult era of the 1990s.
Yeah, difficult's a euphemism, isn't it?
Yes. You know, character building for English cricket. Yeah. But I think it was slightly older vintages than you, and the late 1980s for me, that was the real nadir for me. We lost to countries that didn't even exist, I'm pretty sure, at that point. We lost to countries that hadn't even heard of cricket. We lost a game to the Vatican at one point, I'm pretty sure.
But you still had Gatting, Gower and Botham.
That made it worse.
I never even got to see them play.
England...
The late 80s was not vintage Botham, I think.
No,
it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Gower would still pop up with a beautiful 50, wouldn't he, here and there. But
and he was still in Tiger Moss.
I was at the Oval when we lost to New Zealand that made us officially the worst team in the world.
99.
Was that 99?
99, yeah.
Was it? Yeah.
When Nasser Hussain got booed on the balcony.
Yeah, and Cairns hit the 676s, didn't he?
Yeah.
For New Zealand, yeah. They were
too soon, Mark. You shouldn't be bringing... comedy equals tragedy plus time, and that is only 17 years ago. It's too soon. So, Emma, you write a lot about cricket. England clearly, you know, been pretty strong, bit up and down recently. I mean, it still feels like a hoax. It still feels like this is some kind of, you know, as someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, it feels like this is, you know, something...
What, you're waiting for the rug to be pulled out from under you?
It just feels unnatural that England are, you know, dominating test matches on quite a regular basis.
Yeah, well, I would say they dominate them when they play... when they play as well as they can. They actually, I would say from the opposite point of view, that considering that they have two of the all-time great opening bowling partnership in Broad and Anderson, and they've got two players who are going to go down as history-making players, James Anderson and Alistair Cook. So you've got those three all-time greats probably in your side. You've also got a plethora of batsmen to choose from in your middle order. I would say that considering their resources, that I expect them to do well, and that in some ways I'm surprised that they're not, for example, further up the Test Championship table than they are. They are solid mid-table and have been for a while.
Yes, but that's kind of meaningless, isn't it? I mean, I think India are top at the moment, or have been top very recently, and they have not won a match outside India for... And in fact, they barely even played a match outside India. Because even when they do play test matches, they don't really play a recognisable form of cricket when they're outside India. At home, pretty much unbeatable. But
no, that's right. And I would say that for the Test Championship, a lot of the strategy is actually in your scheduling of test matches.
And you say that, and India have just announced their schedule for the forthcoming season. 13 home test matches.
That's so I think, Paraguay. Yeah. But this is the trouble. I mean, there's a terrible sort of almost curling sort of style crisis with test match cricket, and I just got a terrible feeling that it's not really recognised by the people at the top. So the numbers that turn up at the games and the number of countries that don't take it, most obviously West Indies, but Dhoni really wasn't bothered by tests, was he, by the end with India?
Yeah,
it's interesting, this point system that they've introduced for the Sri Lanka series, which, by the way, yes, is still happening.
It's not had a lot of publicity,
especially when England are thrashing Sri Lanka in the test. We don't really like to think about the fact that, hold on a tick, if Sri Lanka draw this match and then win all the one-dayers, they could actually still win this so-called super series. So no, nobody seems to be particularly bothered about the point system. And I think if Sri Lanka did manage to do all that and somehow came away with the series, we would then think very hard about this point system and think, what does it actually do?
Yeah, well, the
us?
Problem is they've introduced it and they've got the schedule completely wrong. It should have the limited overs games first, so you're getting some points and it's setting up the context for the test series and then the test matches. Whereas they've, you know, the highest scoring matches at the start, they've sort of front loaded it. Sri Lanka, very inexperienced in English conditions.
That's right.
Understandably and collapsing like a prim Victorian lady
exactly,
at the unexpected sight of a gentleman's danglers. And, you know, it's... It's not been a great contest.
The conditions are a major part of it. And this is what I don't really understand about the scheduling. I know it's to do with money, and I know it's to do with fitting as much cricket as we possibly can into our daily lives and into our every minute waking brain thoughts, right? I know that's what it's all about, because the more I think about cricket, the more money the ECB is somehow making somewhere down the line. But shoving the what we think of as the weaker side, the less interesting side, first in the schedule. So they come over when it is still cold. We send them up north, which is basically the equivalent of them having to go beyond the wall, Game of Thrones style, right? They're up there among the wildlings, and you know they've never seen this kind of, you know, terrific cold before, and I feel really sorry for them, because I just think that's all wrong. You shouldn't be basically wasting a series by getting your getting your weaker opponents in adverse conditions and creating a series where you sort of know England are going to win. I mean, it might be a nice build, it might be a nice warm up for the England team, but it's rubbish in terms of actual gameplay.
It can work, can't it? When New Zealand came over 2 years ago, was it? And there was those two matches to start with.
That was like last summer, weren't they? And in fact, 2 years ago, Sri Lanka came in the early summer. They played a bit later. They played in June.
Yeah.
Two test series, and they won it. Two very close games. But the point does stand. And also, we've seen they bowled pretty well yesterday at Lord's. They batted well in their second innings in Durham. So, I mean, and these tours happen now with almost no warm-up games. Yeah. It's almost like they've finally got warmed up just for the end of the series that they've already lost.
Although the nice thing is they have a really good record at Lord's. I mean, when I say good, they haven't actually won there. But they haven't lost at Lord's since 91. I should say that when we were talking about, just to go back to talking about England for a second, I feel like I did Root a disservice by saying that we had three yes. world-class players mentioning him.
I was going to pick you up on that, but then the conversation kind of moved on.
I'll tell you, one of the things I like about Root is when he has a bad day, there's something about the way he walks away from the wicket, which is, you can see he's accepting responsibility for it. Like, he looks to me like a character from Peanuts. Like, yesterday he left his helmet on and he sort of like bit his strap. He had his strap across his mouth and he kind of walked off, sort of head slightly down. I really like that. I like to see somebody walking off the pitch and looking like they're taking responsibility, because I think there is too much now, especially among England players. It happened yesterday with Compton and a few others, where they walk off and they're constantly looking back over their shoulder at the wicket as if, you know, as if something had happened out there that wasn't quite their fault. Like,
yes. Premier League manager that's always going to blame the ref or something.
Yeah, frustrates me.
With Compton, I think he might have been looking back over his shoulder at all his hopes and dreams.
I think so.
Let's move on. We will have exclusive updates on the result of this test match in next week's show. Boxing. Of course, probably the biggest sporting story this week was the death of Muhammad Ali, great boxer stroke global icon, a great outpouring of emotion around the world, some of that emotion being from people who apparently had tickets to his funeral thinking, oh, ka-ching, here's a nice little money-making opportunity. This is surely the logical end of market economics, isn't it? Selling tickets to someone's funeral. I mean, does that show that there is nothing from which we will not, as a species, try to profit?
I suppose you could, as you're getting on a bit, you could start selling them before you go, couldn't you? You could sort of market them in advance, couldn't you? Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Is that you reckon?
It's maybe a secondary ticket market.
You know, like Attenborough. Yeah. He must, you know, now.
Oh, they would shift. Mm. They would seriously shift. But let's move on from talking about how much we would pay to go to David Attenborough's funeral. And are you a boxing fan, Mark?
Well, I am a boxing fan. But, like anyone, Ali was just so much way beyond boxing that he just sort of he was the icon, especially. And I was not quite the perfect age for him, because I don't remember the early years. I don't remember him beating Sonny Liston and then announcing he was Nation of Islam and all that sort of thing. But I do remember the third act of his life, if you like, when he came back and fought the three fights against Frazier and Norton and Foreman and all that time, and he was just extraordinary. He's the first person you jump to, isn't he, when anyone says, oh, but sport is a distraction. It was anything but a distraction. I heard Andrew Young, governor of Atlanta, black governor of Atlanta in the 80s, on the radio the other day. I didn't know this. And he was saying Martin Luther King had not come out against the Vietnam War. all right, that might not be tactically astute while we're fighting for civil rights and all that. What changed his mind was when Ali refused the draft. I don't wonder, it's possible you could say that apart from Martin Luther King, I would think Muhammad Ali was probably the single most important figure in the battle for civil rights, really. It made it a global issue. And obviously, you know, when he fought against Foreman, that was something. With that moment when he knocked out Foreman was about a million things more than sport. Politics, history, social side of it. Even the triumph of Guile over Braun, the man who tactically outthinks the bloke who just runs out of puff. He's used to knocking people out. I would say without question, the most extraordinary sporting moment of my life, with by a long, long way.
It's very interesting because I was chatting to Barney Ronay, the Guardian sports writer, last week about this, and he said his experience of being in America, especially, is that in America, Ali, you know, although to many is a great, great hero, there is still a kind of both ways story about it. There's still conflict. It's in Britain, especially, apparently, that we have turned him into the completely untouchable, unassailable icon he is. And
they've done the same with Ian Botham in America.
And I think that's a really interesting thing. I wonder how much of that is you know, the distance of being in a different country, and you know, we're looking across the water.
Now, on Summer of Sport, we are going to be looking not just at the world's major non-footballing sports, but at some of the lesser sports that don't get so much of the sports media sports spotlights. And as we look ahead to one of the big sporting events later in the summer, spare a thought for one of British sport's most enduring underdogs, who are currently in preparation for their annual big season launch on the 12th of August. Whilst the Olympics might be taking the lion's share of the sports media sports spotlight, spare a thought for one of British sport's most enduring underdogs this, the 12th of August. On moorland across the country, grouse, the renowned bird, are set to resume their annual rivalry with guns and the British aristocracy.
Hello, I am Feathery Len, and I'm a grouse, and I will be competing in the 2016 grouse shooting season for Grouse Birds, Team GB.
Every year, the ancient contest between humankind and grousekind resumes, and every year, odds-on favourites, the humans, come away with another convincing win. No wonder spectator numbers have dwindled alarmingly. Here's Len.
Yeah, sure, we've had a bad run, no doubt about it. There's no point trying to pretend otherwise, but we are more confident this year. We've got to get out there and give it a crack. You'll be proud of representing the grouse and give it 110 grouse percent.
So, Len, why are hopes higher for this season?
Well, everyone starts a new season thinking this could be their year. Otherwise, we wouldn't turn up. And what Leicester City achieved in football has given everyone hope. It's made us think maybe, you know, at least we can get a draw, or at least avoid being shot quite so much. I mean, that'll be something to build on for next year.
Rumours have been circulating in the bird world of a big money deal with Monaco-based Mexico-Russian billionaire oxygen tycoon Igor Emiliano Sanchez Gobulov, who has pledged to invest in a new wing-based micro-rifle system to enable the grouse to return fire on the humans.
Of course, the traditionalists are quite literally up in arms about it. They say we've got the advantage of being able to fly and being much smaller than the elephants they'd really like to be shooting, but when you keep getting the same results year after year, something has to be done to make the sport competitive.
So can we expect to see some new tactics from the grouse, whose tried, tested and not traditionally successful fly-in-the-air-until-you-get-shot strategy has drawn increasingly vocal criticism from the fans? Here's Len again.
Well, Andy, I don't want to give too much away, but in training, our new player coach, Feathery Wes, the wing wizard, has got us doing all kinds of drills, you know, spatial awareness stuff and elusivity-ness, to try and catch the shooters off guard. And then maybe, if all goes according to plan, we'll run a couple of decoy moves, split left and right, and try to outflank them so we can shit on the windows of their cars. Well, it doesn't score you anything, but it's a moral victory, isn't it? After everything we've been through, that's something to take home.
After so many years of defeats, many grouse are rumoured to be on the verge of quitting the sport. Motivation has become an increasing problem in the grouse ranks.
It's not easy. I've lost many friends. My dad went down in a shoot, several of my brothers and sisters, so what might be my brothers and sisters, it's a bit hard to tell when you're a grouse. And Now, the humans are not just using the old technologies like dogs and guns. They're using real-time satellite tracking so they know where we are. They're using drones. They're using electromagnetic pulse bombs that screw up our sense of direction. And special microwave-directed energy weapons that quite literally boil the eggs in our hens' tummies. I mean, is that fair? Is that sport? We don't think so, but you try getting the CIS.
That's the Court of Arbitration for Sport.
Yeah, that's them. You try getting them to give a shit. You might as well try to get a feather out of an aeroplane. Sorry, that's a grouse saying.
So, with not long to go now until the new season, there is at least a hint of optimism amongst the 2016 Grouse squad. A pre-season friendly win against Worms and a low-scoring draw against Tortoises means they have some form under their wings for once. But even after the Ranieri miracle at Leicester, odds of 5,001-1 against suggest that 2016 could be yet another tough season for Len and his flighty friends. Your question. Some of you have sent in some questions. There will be a regular Q&A section in the Summer of Sports podcasts. In future weeks, you can email your questions to azsummerofsports@gmail.com. This week, some of you tweeted me. This came from @NancyAtra, who writes, do you buy that Sharapova was not intentionally doping, and what percent of the Russian Olympic team are doping? In terms of the Sharapova question. Legally, I'm probably not allowed to answer that question. I'm just very sad that she had had the sniffles for so long, or whatever it was. The latest rumours, because she's appealed the ban, and sources within the sports, I'm just hearing now, have suggested compromise could be reached under which Sharapova will return to the circuit immediately, but will only be allowed to play using a slice of watermelon jammed onto a chopstick instead of a tennis racket. And in addition to the chopstick watermelon racket, coincidentally, of course, the name of a prog metal funk band in which the former British number one Tim Henman now plays, Sharapova will be banned from issuing her trademark grunt, which she has used since childhood after scientists proved that tennis players can be distracted by the sound of industrial shipping containers landing on a rhinoceros. Instead, the Russians Starina. I don't know. We'll be forced to blow a swanny whistle as she hits each shot to undermine her credibility as a sporting star. It's thought that seeing a global icon such as Sharapova having to toot out a rather embarrassing whoop after every shot, or of course, ooh, on the back end, will persuade younger players to be a bit more careful about what surprisingly massive cocktails of medication they take.
Has there been a single sports person who's been done for drugs who's then gone, oh, yeah, I had drugs, rather than, oh, what it was is that my mum bought this new sort of window lean and a bit of it got on me knuckles and...
She at least did not have as great an excuse as the Richard Gasquet one.
He smooched a girl in the nightclub.
He got it Frenching.
I think just one look at Richard Gasquet's backhand, he should be allowed to do anything he wants. We have the Russian Olympic ban question. I mean, should they maybe, again, a compromise can be reached where Russian athletes are allowed to compete but have to carry a large rucksack full of hypodermic syringes? Just, you know, some kind of visual punishment.
I feel really uncomfortable making jokes about the Russians. I don't know about anybody else.
Oh, right. Oh, there is a little red dot on just moving on your
phone. It lasted 1 week and then everyone connected with it disappeared.
And if Lance Armstrong had been made to ride the Tour de France after being caught on a unicycle the next year, that would have stopped drug taking and cycling forever.
Surrounded by ducks.
Yeah. No one would have wanted that.
I think we took the Eurovision win away from them. I think the only thing we can do is let Sharapova back.
This came in from @JenHasGreatHair. Did you know that horses in North America run in a different direction than horses in Europe?
What?
Like water down plug holes in the southern hemisphere.
Do they go the other way around?
Well, apparently they run in...
It sounds like an urban myth. Yeah. I thought the plug hole thing was an urban myth, by the way, so that's why I'm a little bit sceptical about this.
No, it's true. It's in The Simpsons, isn't it?
There's a rare series of 40 clockwise horse races are beginning at the Woodbine Racetrack in Toronto. So this could be an absolute revolution in horsey sport. Dressage at the Olympics, that's the horse disco. I've heard there's a hotly... obviously, the home nation's putting a lot of money. Brazil have a breakdancing horse that is apparently going to rip it up in the dressage. Can't wait.
I'm not sure they should... Since they introduced hip-hop into the dressage... It's ruined, isn't it?
And J. Stephen Fox asks, who will win the 24 Hours of Le Mans? Mark, you're a massive expert on endurance motor racing.
Nelson Piquet.
Good guess. Good guess. I think time will be the winner. Time. The concept of time.
And time, once again, wins the 24 Hour.
And this, at Kingston Graham, from your extensive research at London 2012, never forget, I still consider this city as London 2012, is there any greater Olympic spectator sport than wrestling?
It's a good question. I did watch some of the wrestling, actually.
Yes,
at 2012.
I went to a session of wrestling.
It was a nice afternoon off for me. I think I'd been doing the gymnastics in the morning. I probably had to rush to a hockey match. And I actually found the wrestling oddly soothing.
Soothing?
I think my heart rate had been going so high from all the adrenaline of covering everything else. Once I got to the wrestling, it's quite balletic in some ways.
Yes.
And also, it's all that. It is very, obviously, they're all very close, this grappling, you know, there's something incredibly warming about seeing, you know, people with their heads that close together, you know, breathing in the same air. It's a bit like that Maori greeting.
Right.
I loved it.
Doctors will use it for like when people faint or if they're having anxiety attacks.
Yeah,
instead
maybe.
Of a bag over the head, just
some
Greco-Roman wrestling between the fancied Bulgarian and the champion Turk.
So I went to a session and I really enjoyed it. But I didn't know what on earth was going on. I found that most people don't really know the rules of Olympic wrestling. Best to watch it whilst imagining David Attenborough commentating on it as if it's two rare lizards mating. And then it makes a lot more sense. Thanks for your contributions. You can tweet me at Zoltz Cricket, or that email address again is azsummerofsport@gmail.com. Well, that brings us to the end of the inaugural gala world premiere of Andy Zaltzman's Summer of Sport. Next week, we'll be looking at the rugby test matches, the England, Wales and Ireland making the annual trip to the Southern Hemisphere to be ritually humiliated on the rugby field, or hopefully lose by a dignified margin, maybe even win. There's the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. One of the most historic events in sport. Horses at Royal Ascot. Chess boxing. We'll be looking ahead to the London Chess Boxing Championships. What a sport. Have you ever tried that, Mark?
Chess boxing?
Yeah, I believe you have a bit of chess and then a bit of punch.
Oh, it's not
each
the
other
pieces.
The
it's sort of...
Yeah, no, ding, it's ding. A mixture of... Yeah, it's so it's one run round...
It's not boxing with chess pieces in your hand just to make the punches harder.
Yeah. Rookie me eye.
So, yeah, you switch from chess to boxing against the same person.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And how do the points work? You get 50-50?
I've absolutely no idea, but it just... I mean, all I really need to know about that sport is that it exists and that it is the future.
Yeah.
Hybrid sports are definitely the future.
Oh, yes, yeah. Marvellous. Canoeing and weightlifting or...
Well, horse dressage. Ice dressage for me for the next Winter Olympics. That's got to come in. And the US Open Golf is coming up as well. So tune in again next week. Thanks to Mark Steele and Emma John. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Until next time, may the sport be with you.